Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
This episode of Cockpit to Cal is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions. Welcome to Cockpit to Cal, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot AMP and IA and president of Social Flight.
And I'm Brian Schiff. I got my flight instructor certificate when I was 18 years old. So I've been doing it actively ever since, so about 5 years now. Actually, it's been 40, I hesitate to say that. I've been doing it actively ever since then. Gold Seal flight instructor, II, MEI, and on the side, I fly big jets for the airliners.
Well, Brian, this is a really special week. We are not in the normal studios. I'm out here in Las Vegas at NBAA, the National Business Aircraft Association 2025 convention. As a side note to that, to anyone watching, please accept our apologies if there is a bandwidth issue. We're doing the best we can, and it is not very good. But I'm out here for the show and excited to talk to you about tonight's topic. And you don't look like you're at home either.
No, and I don't look like I'm right there with you either, like I was supposed to be. We were going to be doing this together from the NBAA show in Vegas, and I had an opportunity to do some more work. The airline is woefully short of pilots, so I'm out on a trip right now.
I don't blame you. Are you experiencing any of the issues going on right now due to the government shutdown with air traffic control? Because I can tell you it took me, crazy amount longer to get out here than normal.
Yes. So there are certainly issues with air traffic control. I don't blame them. If we could all pony up money and give them loans until they get paid when the government opens up again, I would be happy to do that, because they're working without pay right now. A lot of them are just basically not making the work any harder than it has to be, not getting fatigued. So a lot of people were trying to get closed traffic and get the option, I know a lot of tower controllers won't even do that. It's like, nope, full stop, taxi back each time. So it's difficult to get special things like that. And we as airline pilots know not to ask for direct, not to ask for any favors, don't want to make them have to do any more work. And we're behind them on that. I mean, they're out there working for no income right now, and it's definitely slowing things down. We definitely see a big difference in the operation, but safety is paramount.
Yeah. What is it that actually causes the canceled flights? Is it just availability of controllers given the situation? Again, I am also very sympathetic to what they're going through, but I'm kind of curious.
Yeah. So if, like, let's say a big hub airport has a lot of departures, they'll have many sectors during a time of day when they have a lot of departures, a big departure push. They'll have different sectors open. So many controllers are doing smaller sectors. But if they don't have enough controllers, one controller has to do two or three sectors, or they open it up where they're covering a much larger area. And to not have them have to control as many airplanes as would five controllers normally, they slow down the departures so that there aren't as many aircraft in that sector at one time. Now, our system, we've allowed it to grow so much that any hiccup like that just simply results in delays, because even bad weather will cause delays because we have to space out aircraft because we can't take visuals. When we can take a visual, we can get closer to each other and follow each other. If we're all in the clouds because there's weather, they have to space us apart. There are much more conservative restrictions on how close we can get.
Makes sense.
The system is saturated on a good day. So anything happens, it really slows things down. And it's not to be a pain, and it's not to just inconvenience anybody. It's for your safety. It's to make everything safer. So it's just like if you had 15 airplanes in the pattern, you're not going to get as many circuits in as you would if you were the only one in the pattern.
Yeah. Well, definitely a tough time to fly until things change. I certainly experienced that on the way out when my evening flight turned into a red eye. So anyway, with that,
yeah. Well, I'll add to that one thing. I know that the FAA safety team website also is having some issues. So if you watched our episode of the Shift Show last week, and people can't get to the quiz. It's just we had it in time. It was uploaded before the government shutdown, but right now that page is a little bit messed up and limited, and just people are going to have to be patient until the government gets back to work.
Yeah, getting Wings credit right now, just for anyone who's interested, is definitely going to be a bit of a challenge. So, be patient about that. That is affected by the shutdown. So, there's some things going on with the website. So, Brian, tonight's show, I'm very excited about. It's this concept of breaking the rules for safety.
You're excited about it because you look for any reason to break the rules. I do too.
Yeah, I guess you might be. That might be accurate in a way. I'm excited about it because you've taught me a lot over the years. There's some stories that I'll bring up again now, but that I've learned from you that have to do with this kind of fear. We've talked about fear before, of the idea of declaring an emergency. I want to make sure we talk about that tonight. But there's also the idea, and this applies to maintenance just as much as flying, but the idea that sometimes you need to deviate from standards. And for everybody who's out there, I'd just like to kind of open up the definition for tonight's discussion, that when we use the word rules, we say breaking rules for safety. Rules, I think, as Brian and I have been talking about it, include norms, include customs, include things that you've been taught by your flight instructor or that are guidelines. Some are FARs, Federal Aviation Regulations, but not all. Sometimes it's just breaking these norms for safety. And so I'm going to kick one off for you, Brian, and that is patterns, because that's a perfect example of breaking rules and things like that. And I'll give you one and get your thoughts on it. And that is, if I'm coming into my airport at night, and it's a it's a small airport, not a lot of traffic, especially at night, and surrounded by trees and things like that and hills, I find that if I'm in a direction that lends itself to a straight-in approach even slightly, I consider that to be safer for me because I get established, I see everything, and as long as there's no one around, that seems safer to me than the idea of going in and making a whole bunch of left-hand turns at night when it's a black hole. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. We got to watch out every time we hear the always and nevers and absolutes like that, because you can't say a straight in is always more dangerous than joining the pattern and the recommended 45 degree angle or the way the AIM recommends. There are all these people that say the AIM is not regulatory. It isn't regulatory, but if you find yourself in court after something happens and they say, well, this is the recommended way the FAA says, but you decided that you would do it this way, you just need to be prepared to answer to that. Anytime you can justify, in the interest of safety, doing something different, such as a straight-in approach at night with terrain or hills around you and no lights, I would agree with you. I would for sure say that you're doing something that is much safer to just go straight in, and you're familiar with the airport. Now, you're probably introducing a little bit of risk, and as long as you're aware of the risk you're introducing and you mitigate that risk by maybe some extra radio calls, being vigilant when you're watching for traffic, knowing that you're making a straight in and watching for aircraft in the pattern that might not have radios. So yes, it's okay to not follow the advice of the AIM. The only thing that I would watch out for is violating regulations. The regulations say that all turns must be to the right, all turns must be to the left unless otherwise published. So if you decide that left traffic would be better for you, that right traffic would be better for you, and left is the standard at that airport, well, that's a regulation you're violating. That's actually in the regulations. You better have a good reason for that. If something happens, you need to be able to justify it. Now, there you're going to break a regulation. And pilots can break regulations in the interest of safety to meet an emergency. So there are times when that is much, the more preferred way to go is to break the rule. What you're doing with a straight in, I wouldn't say is breaking any rules. It's going against the recommendation of the AIM, which is what prudent pilots are told to do. However, that's why they don't say you must always, because there are times when going straight in is safer, in such as in the situation that you recommend.
So let me pick up on what you just said then, and kind of pull that thread a bit. And so now let's talk about the type of turns. I have encountered situations before where there's weather right near the airport and on one side of the airport. Now, I'm not talking about something particularly dangerous like, oh, I'm getting really close to a thunderstorm or something crazy. But if there's a fair, if there's a downpour happening that's on the east side of the airport, let's say, and left turns would put me right through that, and there is not traffic happening, then what about the idea of violating those turns and saying, I'm going to make right traffic pattern and call it out in this and why I'm doing that?
So
to make everybody aware, what are your thoughts on that?
So my thoughts on that are, and this is something where a lot of pilots, like you mentioned earlier, are hesitant to declare an emergency. You don't, and let me say this first, there is nowhere in the pilot controller glossary that we're, or even in the AIM anywhere that says declare an emergency, but a pilot in command has emergency authority. And if you're encroaching on a safety situation, you're approaching an emergency situation. An emergency situation or an emergent situation is broken down into, and this is according to the pilot controller glossary, but it's broken down into either a distress or an urgency condition. If you were to get in that rain, you might get yourself into distress. So to consider, okay, this is a little bit urgent here. I don't want to do that. I'm in an urgency situation. I am going to use my authority and do what's safer and fly a right pattern so I don't have to go through that weather. Could I wait for the weather to pass? Do I have the fuel to do that? You know, if you don't, then there certainly a case could be made for flying right traffic. You'd be perfectly within your right. I think that you could justify that. Common sense prevails here. You're breaking a regulation. 91.3B says a pilot in command can break any rule in this part, 91, to the extent required to meet that emergency. And if you have an urgent condition like that, it's not a distress condition yet, but you're trying to prevent that from happening, that's a form of an emergency, and you can exercise emergency authority by flying right traffic. You'd be prepared to explain that afterwards, of course.
Yeah, and obviously in a case like that, you might be explaining why didn't you go to another airport or something like that. But I mean, you know, these situations arise.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of times when, you know, a situation happens. Well, what always comes to mind with this urgency versus distress is when I hear about, or it always brings me back to that memory of the Piper Arrow over Dover, Delaware, had done an IFR flight at night, got after three go-arounds, three missed approaches, was finally diverting somewhere distant after 5.5 hours of flying on 5.5 hours of fuel. Looks down and sees Dover Air Force Base and says to air traffic control, hey, can I land there? Controller says, not unless it's an emergency. So he continues on, loses an engine halfway between Dover Air Force Base and his fourth destination. Now he considers it an emergency. That's a distress situation. The engine just quit. Now, okay, I can go back to Dover. No, if you're overhead Dover and you know you're perilously low on fuel, you say, that's where I'm landing right now. This is urgency. Right. I'm trying to keep it from turning into a distress. I'm gonna land there. So
yeah,
admitting that it could be something that would lead to a distress situation, that's an emergency.
Yeah. So give me an example from your perspective.
Well, there are times when I've been flying towards weather and I need to deviate for weather, for example. And this one's pretty common for airliners or pilots in jets and pilots flying around. I shouldn't say that, pilots who have radar, weather radar, who will tickle the edges of convective activity, but we know how to do it using our radar to avoid it. And you can see something ahead of you and you ask air traffic control, I need 10 degrees left or 30 degrees left. The closer you get, the more degrees left it gets. And they say, stand by, I've got traffic, or stand by, we have airspace. We're going to have to get you. No, you can go right.
Or you just can't reach them, right? I've had that. They're busy.
Yeah, sometimes you can't get a word in edgewise. And some pilots will go right into that weather. They've proven it, and we've had accidents as a result of it. Others will take the lead, exercise emergency authority, take the urgent condition and avoid a distress condition by just starting the left turn by, on themselves. Now, if you can't get a hold of them and you're doing that, I would advise squawking 7700, letting them know that, hey, I'm exercising my emergency authority. I got to make this turn, but under no circumstance should you ever fly into the weather. I got to learn that lesson at a young age on a family vacation in a Cessna 414 watching my dad. And he would not accept a turn into the weather. They wanted to give him IFR clearance. And he says, no, I need to go left. And that was the only option. And it was a restricted area. I think it was somewhere around Edwards Air Force Base. And I think he said, do you want me to squawk 7700 or remain on my current squawk? I'm turning left. And watching that was a good example for me. You watch and learn. And I kind of got a lot of that through osmosis by being around dad. Another one is, let's say that weather was unforecast, went below minimums at your alternate, and you've already, you know, had to missed approach at your destination. Now you've gone to your alternate and it's below minimum, but you're perilously low on fuel. Again, funny how there's a lot of common denominator here. When you're low on fuel, situations become more dire. So just always file that one away. But could you justify going below the published weather minimums, knowing that the obstacle area is clear? You could follow the glide slope down to about 20 feet if you had to, and see the runway and land. Would that be safer, or should you do another go around and try to find an airport where you can not bust minimums? So the obvious answer is bust minimums and land. But there might be some viewers watching this saying, oh gosh, really? And if you are, maybe evaluate what you consider to be an urgent situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely. So what about altitudes? And again, if we're talking about, you know, rules being norms as well, then it seems to me there's an awful lot of VFR traffic that's at 2,500 feet.
Yeah.
And everybody seems to cling to 2,500 feet, which, you know, I'm not a CFI, but that doesn't seem to be the smartest thing in my book. And occasionally 3,500 feet, of course. But, like, why are we kind of grouping people so much at low altitudes in a way that seems like that rule or guideline might not be the smartest thing in the world? Like, so like, is it that bad to be at 2,700 feet?
Exactly. That rule, pilots are doing that to themselves that low, because the rule doesn't kick in until you're above 3,000 feet. If I take a student flying, and we're going to go out and do some air work, I tell them to level off at 2,730 feet. Like 2730, like, yeah, if you can hold 3,000, you can hold 2730. So if you're within 3,000 feet of the ground, AGL, so let's say the ground is at 1,000, you can go all the way up to 4 and cruise if you want without worrying about the hemispherical rule plus 500, odd and even plus 500. And I will give them that. And here, I'm also the guy who I ask if I'm teaching in a new area, or I go to give someone a flight review, I'll ask them, where's the practice area here? Where does everybody go to practice? And they'll show me, oh, everybody goes over here. Okay, we're going to go over there. I don't want to go over here. Don't want to be
that's
where everyone
I was going to think of is like the practice areas. Like, do you really want to go there? That seems like the beehive of the least experienced people possible.
Yeah, there's either a riot here or a 21-gun salute. I'm not sure which. But, no, I don't want to go where everybody else is. And you don't have to go to the practice area. Find me that in the regulations or the AIM. It's a common local lore, and it's maybe a good place to go practice because for certain reasons, but you can find another area. I like to stay away from those areas that are common practice areas. For the same reason, I like to avoid cardinal altitudes like 3,000 or 2,500 or 2,000. Below 3,000 feet, I will level off at something weird. You know, the other day I had to move my airplane to take it to annual, and I instead of flying at 17, you know, the Bravo above me was at 2,000 feet. So you'll see people at 1,800, at 1,700, or whatever. I do 1,650 or 1,750, and just kind of stay in between the altitudes in case there's someone there that I don't see. So I try to avoid where everybody else is. If I'm approaching a VOR and I got to make a turn there and it's a lot of airways there, whether I'm IFR or VFR, if I'm VFR, I'll cut the corner by a lot. IFR, you're allowed to turn a little bit early to intercept the new airway, but I try not to pass directly over VORs as well. Although nowadays everybody's going direct, so that kind of helps. But as far as cruising altitudes, you know, 3,500, 4,500, 5,500, we don't have too many from which to choose. And we're, a lot of us are at the same exact altitude. And I know that I had someone reach out to me and say, you got to talk about this. This is a rule. The hemispherical rule is one that you can justify breaking because, and studies were done a long time ago about how many near mid airs and collisions that we had because aircraft were at the exact same altitude when they could be 100 or 200 feet off. The problem is we don't know where the other aircraft are going to be. The standard really isn't set yet. And there might be someone else, you know, if you go at 6,500 feet and you say, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to go at 6,700 feet. Well, now you're 300 feet closer to the IFR altitude of 7,000 feet. And IFR, they can go, you know, really up and down plus or minus 300 feet, or if they're private pilots, if they're commercial or ATP, they're held to plus or minus 100. I don't think the snitch alarm at ATC goes off until you're 300 feet off your altitude. So we have a problem with the IFR and VFR mixing, and I think for now I'm not going to condone flying a different altitude than what the regulations say. But down low, you certainly can, below 3,000. Or here's the thing. Yeah, if you want to take advantage of that rule, it's cruising altitude. It's the cruising phase of flight. And if you don't want to cruise at that altitude, well, maybe I'm climbing to another altitude, but I'm going to do it at about maybe 2 feet per minute and VFR, not IFR. So you could kind of use that. Well, I'm not in the cruise phase, I'm in a climb phase. So that's another way to kind of cheat your way out of that, but being at the same altitude as other.
I like that. That's a, you ever, I know at the lower altitudes, like you said, before it actually starts, I did a flight recently to Provincetown, and when I was going over Boston, I kind of asked to be at a 20, I think it was 1700, and they're like, yeah, that I think it worked better for them. There's some interesting kind of tricks and things you can do. I think they like it when you do that.
There's other issues. I mean, there's so many. Like, what if you lose radio communications? I'll tell you the story I had. If you lose communication with the tower, or whether they lost comm, maybe they got COVID and they evacuated, or you just change the frequency, or you lose your radio, or you knock the radio, something happens, you're not talking to the tower, and you realize you're down at like 100 feet, and or maybe they're just busy talking, and you realize you don't have a landing clearance, and you're going into a busy towered airport. The runway's clear. What is it safer to do a go around into all that busyness and traffic and congestion, or just it's 100 feet? You should have got a landing clearance, you didn't, but it would arguably be safer to just go ahead and land. And I think many controllers would probably thank you to just go ahead and land, and we'll talk about, you know, okay, slap my hand, I didn't get a clearance, or slap your hand, you didn't give me one. Either way, I couldn't get a word in, and I thought it was safer than going around, so I continued to land.
Interesting.
The story I was going to tell was going into Chicago O'Hare, and very busy, they're operating parallel arrivals, visuals, and here's down one final, and I'm on base leg for the other final, and we're going to turn and do that, right? Well, on base leg, I tried, you know, we're always staying ahead, so I reached down to my radio, and I'm tuning in the tower frequency, because I know that's what's coming next. We're talking to approach control, I'm tuning the tower, and while we were on base heading toward the parallel finals, it's got kind of your, I realized that now I'm hearing the tower. I looked down and oh crap, I tuned it in the active side of the radio, not the standby side. So I now just changed the frequency off of approach control to the tower controller. And the approach controller is the one that was going to turn me final, so I'm not pointed at the other parallel runway, final approach. Well, you're very limited on time here. I didn't have time. I don't remember what the frequency was for approach control. I'm certainly not going to try to go hunt that down at that point. And I'm certainly not going to just stay on that heading and go into the final approaches for the final approach to the parallel runways at O'Hare. So I told my first officer, I said, just turn final. I'll call the tower. And when I got a chance, I called the tower and I said, hey, we lost the communication with the approach controller. I didn't say why. It was my fault. But nevertheless, we did. And I said, so we just turned final. Hope that's okay. And he goes, no, we're glad to see that you did that. Thank you very much. You're cleared to land 9 right. And that's how it was. So you got to use your head sometimes. And sometimes you don't have a lot of time to think about whether you need to reestablish radio communications or just immediately establish the loss of comm procedures.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny because as you start talking about some of this, one of the things that occurs to me is that we should do a show at some point on like sort of tips and tricks to work the system. Because there are things you can do. I may or may not have requested city tours in order to get through Bravo airspace.
Yeah, there are things like that. And there are also back when I was teaching in the Bay Area, and the only way to get to the MEAs, the only way to get across the hills from the east, from the Central Valley over to the Bay Area was to get up to the MEA, but the MEA had freezing. It was above the freezing level. So if I went to the MEA, I'm down in the Central Valley, we're not going to make it. So I shot an instrument approach into Livermore, full well knowing I was going to miss the approach because the holding pattern is over in the Bay Area. So I shot the instrument approach into Livermore, did the missed approach. I said, we're going to divert to our alternate and I'm going to go to San Jose now. And that kind of got me into the Bay Area on IFR without having to go up, use the airway system. In an emergency or an urgent situation, I could argue that's a safer thing to do than to go up into icing conditions to make it at the MEA. And if I told air traffic control, look, I've got an emergency situation, which the proper way to say that is with Mayday or Pan Pan. That's what the AIM says. But the controllers understand here in the U.S. when you say I have an emergency situation or it could turn into one if I can't get above this altitude. They're going to bend over backwards to help you. And if flying an approach into Livermore, missing the approach, and then going, you're on a published route with minimums and terrain and obstruction clearance that's already been vetted out, that's the safer way to go than to go up into icing conditions and not admit that you have a situation.
So, I like that. So let's make that a future show because that's a really good teaser. And then we can talk about all the tricks to get through Bravo airspace or tricks to doing different things or tips on how to do stuff.
How to avert delays. Yeah, I got a lot of those.
we've accumulated between the two of us, I think, quite a few few little things. I think the thing is, do we want to give them all away?
We'll give some away. You know, sometimes you think a Kobe Maru? Is that what it was called when you're in a no-win situation and there might actually be an out? And controllers will sometimes help you with that.
Well, we'll talk about things like that or special VFRs or all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's interesting as we were talking about this and thinking about the show, I was thinking about also where this applies to maintenance. And from my perspective, this applies in many cases on the difference between recommended maintenance and what maintenance is actually smart to do.
Well, now in my program, we talked about, you know, how dangerous a flight right after maintenance is, right?
Yeah.
So I decided I'm not ever going to have any maintenance. And then I don't have any of those situations.
Yeah. How's that working out for your mags, Ryan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good thing we sent them out, and it's a good thing for the 500 hour. I need new mags, and they were worse off. They're being rebuilt. They were worse off than we thought they were. So I'm glad that we sent them out and found out something wrong with them before I found out while I was flying.
Right. So that's the key, I think. When we're talking about maintenance and we're thinking about sort of breaking the rules or breaking, I hesitate to use rules when we're talking about that, but, you know, recommendations. We need to be thinking in those cases about, is recommended maintenance in certain circumstances, like by the manufacturer, let's say, is that always the safest thing for you to be doing? And it depends on on the scenario. It depends what you're talking about. If we're talking about something that's a known wear item, like a Magneto, then in the situation that you just discovered, that we shouldn't defer that. That is incredibly important maintenance. Magnetos are very much wear items, and most of the time, when you do a 500-hour or 1,000-hour inspection for overhaul of a mag, you find stuff. I mean, those numbers are there for very good reason. At the same time,
$1,600 worth of stuff.
Is that really what it is?
$840 each on top of
You know why I can smile? It's not me. That's why.
Right. Yeah.
At the same time, I've looked at the sort of recommended maintenance by manufacturers, and those are not necessarily on condition. Those might have been created, let's say, because the FAA at the time certifying the aircraft said, no, we really want you to put your number on it. Something like that. There's something like the gearbox, the transmission on the Bonanza that I fly. And there are other ways that you know if this is healthy, that you can tell how this is doing. Is it healthy? Is it leaking? Has it ever hit the stops? Is everything else? And it's so simple that it's pretty safe to know how am I doing within that. And yet, if we decided to yank it out to, quote, overhaul it just because it said something in the maintenance manual as to what a guideline was, well, there are so many things that are disturbed in that process that are critical to the landing gear that if everything is perfect now, the chances that everything will be perfect in the end aren't wonderful. There's probably some bugs you're going to have to work out and adjustments you're going to have to make to get back to zero, to get back to where you started.
Those bugs don't always show themselves. I mean, it may not be apparent to you, right? Like my mags, I would not know.
You would hope so, right? You would hope that you could get there through swinging a gear on the ground, but you don't necessarily.
Is that like swinging a compass?
Yeah. It you don't necessarily, because there's wind loads and other things that can you know, all of a sudden you find out you need an adjustment. And I've seen this with flaps. I've seen this with other things where, you know, they went through a process. And it brought on a lot of issues. And so I do think that this is the kind of thing where we want to be careful of guidelines versus on condition versus what is a real wear item. What are you really concerned about? And I'm not advocating for things having to do with, you know, engines or propellers, but.
Right. But can you think of any specifics? What are some specific examples of what you're talking about? Like, I know one thing is recommended oil change. I mean,
that's a no-brainer, right? Because we know that oil is a wear item.
Yeah.
Not just the metal. This is something people often confuse. They think putting oil in is preventing wear, and so this is all about wear of metal parts. And the reality is somewhat different. The reality is that in most of the components in the engine, oil forms a boundary layer. It's like a hydrostatic floating essentially that happens in the bearings, and those you're not getting metal to metal contact. It's not really about metal wear in that regard in some of the components. However, we know that oil breaks down over time. We know that's why we put 4 months and 50 hours with an oil change, 25 hours with an oil screen. We know that there's really good reasons for that those things need to be done. And okay, so I'd say no.
You said very obvious, but to me it wasn't. I'm like, which way is it obvious? I don't know the answer to that. But as I listen to you, what I'm hearing is you should not go beyond those recommended times on either operation time on the engine or time since the last oil change, right?
Yes. And so I look at other things where I'm always weighing the risk of what we're disturbing versus the benefit of what we're getting. And so I look at something like, let's say, control surfaces, mm-hmm. where you look at something. I've had cases where the measurable wear is of something like a bearing or a bushing or something is just barely, like it's nothing extreme. and you sit there and you go, oh, well, we're really supposed to replace these on this regular basis. And I think, how invasive is this procedure that we're doing? Yeah. If we really know that there's either no perceptible reason to be doing it or barely a perceptible reason to be doing it, then I start thinking about what are the implications of removing a control surface to do this minor thing and then putting it all back together, and what risk have we introduced? And that makes me hesitate on following certain guidelines.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I know at one point I'd asked you about the clevis bolts on my struts that hold them on, and there's some corrosion on them. To me, corrosion bad. I see corrosion, and on the surface it looks worse. And then you explained to me that, you know, you don't have to go do anything about that yet, because it's a certain percentage of the material thickness that you need to worry about. But okay, it may be aesthetic to me, but is the aesthetics worth taking the strut connector off and putting the strut back on again? I think the risk for that, exactly, to me, not worth it.
So, and that's a perfect example. For everybody on the call, that particular case, we weren't talking about corrosion in terms of depth of corrosion and everything else. We were talking about surface. We were talking about something that you could look at and take some Scotch-Brite and clean up, and that's it.
Right.
And the idea of like putting new hardware on because of something, I know mechanics that do that. I know mechanics that look at it and they're just always replacing hardware. You know, if there's any surface corrosion whatsoever, they're always replacing it. And
right.
I'm thinking to myself, there's a lot of risk every time that you're doing all of that.
Yeah. And if you ask a mechanic, hey, can you do more work for me? They're going to say, sure, I'll do more work for you. Yeah,
no, that's my true. Hourly rate,
I'm happy. No, but my mechanic wouldn't do that. They actually pointed out a lot of watch things, some items that we need to keep an eye on these things. So, I mean, a good mechanic won't do that, but, you know, you never know.
So we'll refund
everything you paid to attend this webinar.
Yes, yes. And the FAA will be issuing you your wings credit when they return next January.
It's all because of the government shutdown.
Yeah, I think that's what's affecting this, clearly.
It's got to be.
Anyway, so Brian, any other kind of concepts about rules and stuff? I know I've talked in the past a bit about some other things that have come up for me, things that have to do with putting myself at risk in past stories, having to do with weather or having to do with fuel, because I was worried about customs and plans I had made. Or things like that. What other thoughts do you have?
Yeah, so I think it's important to reiterate a paragraph in the AIM in 6-1, the emergency 611 and 612. That's the emergency information in the AIM, and I think it's worthy of discussion about where the AIM specifically says pilots don't hesitate to declare a distress situation. My engine failed. I'm out of control. I've hit something. I've lost whatever. Pilots don't hesitate to do that, but pilots are very hesitant to declare an urgent situation, which is something that can lead to a distress situation. And I want to make that very clear, that as soon as something is out of the ordinary, you notice that your lights dim when you hit transmit on the radio, you know you're losing your electrical, something is coming. This is the time to aggressively address it as an emergency before it becomes dire. And I'll read directly from the AIM. It says, pilots are reluctant to report any urgency condition when they encounter situations which may not be immediately perilous, but are potentially catastrophic. An aircraft is in at least an urgency condition the moment the pilot becomes doubtful about position, fuel endurance, weather, or any other condition that could adversely affect flight safety. So I think that's important to file that away.
Yeah, I think that is important. And ultimately, I think as pilots, I know it took me a really long time to overcome this idea that I need to do what's right for me before I need to follow the instructions I'm given in many situations.
Yeah, just imagine you've got that FAA's family in the aircraft with you, and you're going to explain to them when you get there why you did what you did, because you wanted to keep them safe and keep them alive. And the FAA will think of the same for you. When you say, I had to go around this regulation because it was much safer to do so, and you felt that way, you know, unless it's some kind of willful violation to try to cut off other aircraft or shorten or make up for your poor planning. And it might even be making up for your poor planning. At that point, it might become a bad thing. And you might have to talk about that later. But the goal is to stay alive and stay safe. And I really don't know of any regulations that I don't like. And I really love the fact that I have the leeway to just forget them if I need to in the interest in safety. There is another one that you'll see a lot of people do unwittingly. There's a regulation that says at towered airports, you're not allowed to go below the visual approach slope indicator, the visual path, PAPI or the VASI. But it does say, unless necessary for a safe landing. And I think you could argue quite often, if you're flying a twin or your airspeed indicator is in op or whatever, that I need to go below the PAPI to use up as much runway as I can. Or if it's a very short runway and landing beyond the PAPI or staying above it might otherwise really push it on your runway limits. Whereas if you landed earlier on the runway, it wouldn't. So it says, unless otherwise required for a safe landing, no pilot will go below the visual approach slope indicator. So bear in mind that a lot of those regulations say unless required for safety or unless, you know, needed for safety. A lot of them say that.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. So I think whether it's, you know, what you choose to do for maintenance and whether, you know, weighing a guideline, or whether we're talking about avoiding an emergency situation or just, you know, other types of rules, I think, you do what's best for you. And I think that's what really matters the most. And your experience, yeah, especially with airlines and knowing what you choose to do is extremely valuable.
Yeah. And I've had to do that on a number of occasions. Sometimes if there's time and I have the ability to tell air traffic control first, you should do that. Obviously, if you can, you should. There are times you can't get in over at Edgewise, or the emergency or the urgent situation requires that you exercise your authority. You don't have to declare anything to exercise your emergency authority. You need to be willing to talk about it afterwards, and you need to be reported ahead of time if you have time. But let's say, for example, there's a fleet of RVs coming at me, you know, a whole swarm of them. And the only winning move I have right now to get away from them is to go into Class Bravo airspace to make an evasive maneuver. I would do that. And we'll talk about it all day long afterwards. I'll call the FAA afterwards and I'll explain to them, hey, here's what happened. Nobody's going to, you know, they're going to work with you on that. Well, how did the situation come about? If it's through no fault of your own, and of course it usually isn't, then there's not going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But it's better than crashing into the RVs.
Well, everybody, you heard it first here. Brian never met a regulation he didn't like. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
Oh, you're going to find one. You're going to find one. I think they're pretty liberal. I think they let us do a lot, and they have a lot of leeway in them for safety. But a lot of them are written in blood, and they're there for a reason. And I think if you research enough, throw me one that you think you don't like and shoot it my way. Let's talk about it. Maybe I'll agree with you. And if it is, we'll try and get it changed.
Well, that's the challenge. I like that. That's exactly what we're all doing, and maybe you'll be leading the charge on that next change. Well, Brian, we managed to somehow survive like literally 1 megabyte per second in our two hotels to try to bring a show that I hope was of value to people, regardless of the struggle to make it happen. And I'd just like to say to everyone, thanks for putting up with this and being patient with the quality. If you had issues getting in, if you had issues being able to see good resolution, it does matter. We will be back next month from our regular home locations with full power bandwidth and another really, really valuable show as we talk about some other things, which may include those little tricks and tips for how you accomplish some things you want to, about how you work the system. That might be a fun thing for us to do. And we've also talked about having a show coming up where we address all your questions and just kind of have a little bit of a free-for-all interaction, which allows us to do something that we don't usually get a chance to do and interact directly with you.
That'll be a good one.
That really will be, absolutely. Back next Tuesday, Social Flight Live is back with Heidi Porch, who had an amazing experience. Her story of ditching in the Pacific on a real ferry flight, surviving that. It is a tale of survival you really need to hear for yourself. So please join us, socialflightlive.com, and that's Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. And and then we'll be off for a bit. And then we've also got that show coming up with Hoot Gibson again. And Brian, what's going on your next shift show?
On the next shift show, we're going to have Ned Parks, who's been a fantastic advocate for avoiding wake turbulence, especially helicopter wake turbulence. He has a fantastic presentation that I've seen several times on the invisible monster that, you know, if it hasn't gotten you, there are those who have and those who will if they don't respect it. That wake turbulence is something we're going to talk about in detail that needs to be taken seriously. And that'll be on the second Thursday of November.
Ooh, I really want to learn about that. I want to learn about that for helicopters 13th? On the ground, because I've been nailed by that too.
Very much so. Yeah, yeah, very much so. When you're on the ground or maneuvering near helicopters, they have wake turbulence as well. And it's important to know where they are, especially if it's a big helicopter.
Yeah, there was one year that I had my aircraft on display at an event. I think it was down in Plymouth or Mansfield, and there was a Coast Guard helicopter, big helicopter,
yeah,
that was parked right near me, and it went to take off, and I was like, I was really worried about what that was going to do.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be November 13th with Ned Parks, and then this Saturday, the 18th in the morning, if you're in California and you're a member of Cal Pilots, they have a fun event called California Zooming with a bunch of webinars or all day long seminars for Wings Credit. And the John and Martha King will be giving some presentation, but Dad and I are going to kick that off with a keynote and with some fun anecdotes and advice that we've learned over the years to help your flying also. That'll be this Saturday morning. I think it's at 9:30 Pacific time. And look for Google California Zooming or Cal Pilots Association.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we've come to the end of another show, Brian. Thank you so much for everything you do for all of general aviation. And I absolutely love doing the show with you, my friend.
You as well. I had fun. It's good to see you. And you clean up nicely.
Yeah. Hard to believe, right? Go figure. If any of you just happen to be out here at NBAA, please track me down. Would love to meet you in person. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight, and I wish you all blue skies.
Good night.